Welcome to the Psychology World podcast with me, Connor Whiteley, psychology student and international best-selling psychology author of over 30 psychology books, bringing you the latest psychology news, fascinating psychology topics and more each week. If you want to learn more, then please check out connorwhiteley.net/books. And don't forget to like and subscribe to the YouTube video or follow on your favourite podcast app. And here's the show. Hi everyone and welcome to episode 257 of the Psychology World podcast with me, Connor Whiteley. And today's episode is on what therapists should tell clients about the first therapy session. And it is the Saturday, the 16th of March, 2024, as I record this. So in today's podcast episode, I wanted to go back to clinical psychology, but I also wanted to focus on something that wasn't so much a therapy itself, but an aspect of psychological therapy that a lot of us sort of know about because we study, we learn, and some of us have been through therapy ourselves as part of our psychology journey, but we never really think about it from the client's point of view. So in today's podcast episode, I'm going to be talking about a list of questions or concerns that clients have, which we should be able to understand, and maybe, especially if we're more of a private therapist, then we should actually tell our clients about before the first therapy session, just so we can help relax them, reassure them about the process, and basically just reaffirm that everything that they're feeling is perfectly normal. So that's something that we're going to be looking at in the content parts of today's episode. So moving on to the psychology news section, we're reading from the British Psychological Society Research Digest, and the first one is how to tell a joke to an ape. Even before they can speak, most babies will playfully tease adults they know well. An 8-month-old might offer a toy, but then withdraw it at the last minute, for example, or attempt to do something naughty while smiling and watching the adult's face for a reaction. This tells us that babies at this age understand what adults expect in an interaction, and that babies get pleasure from defying these expectations. This sort of behaviour is thought to be the prelingual precursor to more sophisticated joking. Now, a study by Isabella Lamb and colleagues report very similar behaviours in 4 species of great apes. Their work, which involved video analysis of zoo animals, suggests that our shared sense of humour evolved in a common ancestor at least 13 million years ago. So this, I think, is quite a fascinating one because this, I think, we can definitely see in everyday life. And like, I remember some of my own interactions with children, and you like young babies, then they do like to joke about it. They do love to do something naughty, I say in air quotes, with a massive smile on their face because they sort of know that a cute baby smiling, you can't moan at that. You can't tell off a smiling, happy baby as much as you might want to. You just can't. You seriously can't. And it's quite funny to see. So I definitely understand the theory behind this research. And I think that analysing zoo animal photos is quite a clever way of doing it, because it does show that we do have this evolutionary basis of humour. So of course, evolution is not the answer to every single behaviour, and there are lots of human behaviours which evolution doesn't really apply to, but there are lots that it actually does though. I know I've done this in some podcast episodes when I've looked at how stuff like personality disorders and also dyslexia, they're actually cognitive strengths, but they're also adaptations through evolution in that, these evil mental health conditions that modern society believes that they are. So definitely check out those podcast episodes if you're interested I love them and I've got to do more of them in the future. So I think the only thing that I would say here is that slightly negative is analysis of zoo animals. I think that's an interesting one because, of course, it's the easiest way to do it. But my concern, I say in air quotes because I'm not actually that concerned, but I think my criticism or at least limitation would be, can we really generalize the behavior of the zoo animals compared to wild animals? Even though I guess that zoo animals are the only ones you can actually research because they're easier to find and there's more of them available. So I think it's just something to think about. This is a really good report. So the next one is, to pee or not to pee? Now this is actually quite a good one because it's talking about pee values. Open quote. It is an enduring irony that psychologists are at pains to emphasize that behavior lies along a continuum and diagnostic categories are somewhat arbitrary. Yet, when it comes to statistical inference, we largely still focus on a 5% p-value threshold. Arguments around if and how we should use p-values have raged for years. But thinking beyond p-values and testing point no's, i.e. simply whether or not there is a difference from the no, could help us to get a better handle on whether reported results are credible. Close quote. And then in the new issue of the Psychologist magazine, then they actually talk about p-values. That and there's a researcher who's actually sharing his thoughts on the credibility in how psychologists report results. So, I mean, I am not going to talk too much about this because I've learned about this way too much in statistics last term. But one thing I do want to clear up is that p-value is not about truth. A p-value is not if something has a statistical significance, it doesn't mean it's true. All that it means is that a p-value under 5% so means that it is very unlikely that you're going to get the results that you've collected by chance. That's all that it means. It doesn't indicate truth. It doesn't indicate that it's basically anything other than the results and the observations that you collected from your data, you didn't get them by chance. That's all that it means, to be honest. So I think it's interesting. And yeah, I mean, I would go into this, but I mean, I've spoken about this before and it's just like statistics. I just don't want to focus on statistics, but I really do recommend that if you are interested in statistics and you're interested in this sort of topic, then definitely look it up for yourself. And if you go onto the statistic webpage on ConnorWiley.net, then I do talk about some of these problems with the p-value. So the final one is, a time before dementia. Dementia afflicts around 900,000 people in the UK and an estimated 55 million people worldwide. For a baby born in the UK today, their lifetime risk of developing Alzheimer's disease or a related dementia is, as things stand, a staggering 1 in 3. But has dementia always been such a scourge? A new review of texts from ancient Greece and Rome in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease suggests that it hasn't. The authors argue that there have been lessons about our modern lifestyle and environment to learn from this, but firm conclusions are difficult to draw. Okay, so this I think is definitely quite a fascinating one. I think I've got quite a few takes on this. So yes, we know the chemicals, the environments, what we're doing as a modern society isn't helpful. Like our processed food, that's going to have a long-term implication for us. The sedentary lifestyle, X, Y, and Z. So the list of things that we shouldn't do, or the things that are probably going to affect us, are definitely quite long, but we're still going to keep like doing them. But I also think that it's important to note that life expectancy changes, like from as far as I know, and to be honest, I think this is quite accurate. Well, where people in the modern age obviously lived a lot longer than the people in ancient Greece and ancient Rome, because nowadays we've got better medical care, we've got better sort of like knowledge, and we know how to keep ourselves healthy. That and the risk of like predators, diseases, etc., that was about in ancient Rome and ancient Greece, they aren't as present as in like today's world. But in like today's world, we've got other threats too. And the reason why I'm talking about this is that because dementia is about cognitive decline, and it's more common in older people and people over a certain age, then there's a chance that because we've got a larger population and more people are reaching this more vulnerable time, which where they're more likely to get it, compared to ancient Greeks and ancient Romans, then this could be one explanation. So I think it's a really good article. I think it's a fascinating take on it. And I do recommend that you read it over at the BPS Research Digest website. So I really hope that you enjoyed the psychology news section. I know that I did. So let's move on to the person update. So this week has involved quite a lot of different psychology bits and pieces, because I've been researching a brand new psychology book though, which I'm really excited about, and I'm looking forward to like writing that up, getting it developed over time, so that I am like looking forward to. And my second psychology study was approved by Ethics on Monday. So I've been distributing that, contacting different people so they can share it. And I've not looked at the different responses yet. Well, I know people have actually been doing it, which is really, really nice. And I'm really excited about like this one, because it will be a lot of fun. And yeah, this one I'm just really excited about. But I will admit that releasing a study end of March, mid of March, is a little problematic, because as everyone like knows him, or the vast majority of people do, because they've been like psychology students, what happens is that you need to do so many studies for course credit. Now online and at my university we call this research participation scheme at RPS, but the problem is, as I've released a study mid-March, so I can't do the study any longer than the 2nd of April. But all the really good students, they always tend to do their RPS credits about halfway through the term. So I'm not getting those published. And to be honest, I'm not getting any published through RPS at the moment. So I think I might have shot myself in the foot. But I just wanted to get this research study started. So I might have to, I really, really hope this is not the case whatsoever. But depending on how many participants I get by contacting different groups, different social networks I'm in, I might have to continue data collection into September. Yeah, well, when RPS opens again, because I do want to try and get some psychology students in abode. So, just something to think about. And the many finer problems of research. But also this week, something I want to talk about is I had a really weird confidence boost. So what happened was that my dissertation supervisor, who now has a lot more dissertation and students this year, because I'm now doing masters. So I see some of his students every Wednesday, and we talk, we catch up, we socialize on a Wednesday when they're meant to be doing work, and I'm also meant to be doing work, but we end up talking about such good stuff that we actually don't. And a while ago, I offered, oh yeah, like if you send me your introduction and your like method section, I'll look through it like for you, because I've done my dissertation like last year, so I know what sort of things that they expect. So on Wednesday, because I didn't see them like this week, one of them actually emailed it to me, and I was like, oh god, like I don't think I have anything to offer you, because I'm not an academic, my academic writing's not the most amazing, and so I had a lot of like self-doubt. And to be honest, the reason why this is quite important is because when I get involved in the Parkinson Centre a bit more, well, my friend who's the researcher clinical associate, he actually wants me to supervise a bunch of master's students and undergrad students for their research projects, which means I'm actually going to have to read dissertations and drafts and make comments about how to improve it. And I was like, I can't do that. I'm not good enough. So I read this girl's introduction, her method section, and like it was really good though. Like, she's a brilliant student. Like, I know that anyway. But it was really nice for me to see it though, but also for me to make improvements, like some structural changes. And it was actually a massive confidence boost that I am good enough, that I do know academic writing, and I'm not as bad as I think. So that was really, really nice, like confidence boost. So the tale of the story here is that if you think you're bad at something, don't dismiss yourself, don't be self-deprecating until you've actually done it. And even if you're bad at one time, you can get better. So I just wanted to say that to like people. And then like this week, I've just been like socializing a lot, had some lovely evening with like friends, and I've just been talking to like lots of people. So life is really, really good, thankfully. And as always, I always love to know your thoughts and feelings on today's episode. So you can always email me, ConnorWiley@ConnorWiley.net. You can always leave a comment at the show notes at ConnorWiley.net/podcast. And you can always tweet me on Twitter at SciFiWiley. I always love to hear from all you, because it really helps make the podcast feel more like a conversation. And you can always leave a comment on the Facebook post at ConnorWiley, psychology author. And today's episode has been sponsored by Social Media Psychology. So the reason why I wanted to use this book as the sponsored product for today's episode is because I've not spoken about this book for ages. And what reminded me of it was in like today's episode, we're talking about therapy, we're talking about mental health, like depression and anxiety, and a lot of like social media does have a negative impact on our mental health, but it can also have positives for our mental health. So this great, really easy to understand book doesn't just slate social media. It actually looks at the cognitive psychology behind social media. And it also talks about how does social media maintain depression, how does it cause it, but also how can it also benefit our mental health. So this is a really interesting book. I really enjoyed it, and I really do recommend it. Especially if you want a really nuanced take, and also quite an in-depth look into social media and how it impacts our mental health. So that's Social Media Psychology, available from all major ebook retailers, and you can order the paperback and the hardback version from Amazon, local bookstore or local library if you request it. And you can also get the audiobook version narrated by artificial intelligence at select audiobook retailers like Kobo, Barnes & Noble, Google Play, and selected library systems. So I really do recommend it. It's a great book and I loved it. So whilst buying books helps to support the creation and the editing of the podcast, my time is sponsored by my wonderful patrons. And as always, a massive thank you to my patrons. Your support shows that you like the show and you want it to continue. So if you wanted to become a patron and get tons of great rewards, now you can at patreon.com/thepsychologyworldpodcast. So that's enough of the personal update. Let's move on to the content part of today's episode. So moving on to the content part of today's episode. So we're going to be talking about what therapists should tell clients about the first therapy session. This is really like a fun episode. It's really like useful, and there's some personal stories in here too. So let's dive into it. Also, I do want to announce here that whilst this podcast episode is more aimed at private therapists and mental health professionals, because I presume it is just easier for them to contact their clients, I think that this is still a useful episode for public sector workers, because you can learn and understand our clients more through this, as well as you might want to adopt answering some of these questions into your own service, just a thought. And I should also note that, as always, nothing on this podcast is any sort of official advice whatsoever. Do therapists offer free introduction sessions? A lot of clients have never been to a therapy before and aren't 100% sure about its value. Can I be concerned about the cost? So a lot of our clients like the idea of having a free session before they commit to spending money. A lot of therapists do offer free sessions in one form or another. For example, most therapists offer free phone consultations or shorter free sessions. Like my therapist offers a free 20-minute session for in-person visits. These free sessions are useful for seeing if a therapist is the right fit for you, because there's a chance of finding a therapist that is right for you is like a process of trial and error. However, I want to stress that different therapists often debate the ethics and the finances of offering free sessions, because they have to pay the bills, they have to earn a living, and they went to university or did a level 4 course to get their qualifications. So don't they deserve the right to be paid for their time, skill and work? Therefore, whenever a therapist talks with a potential future client, it is useful to talk about any free sessions they offer. For example, I know my therapist is willing to talk to people about an alternative payment plan if they're on a lower income. Will therapists ask about family history? I think because I studied clinical psychology, this isn't a question that pops up too much, because I always knew where the answer was yes. But some clients will not know this, and they will be a little concerned about sharing aspects of their family to someone who is effectively a stranger to them. As a result, it's useful to share with potential clients that family history will be spoken about. This is something that the large majority of therapists do ask about. At some point in the course of the therapy, since it's important to learn about any family history of depression, anxiety, addiction, or any other mental health conditions. Although it is worth noting that not every therapist likes getting into this information in the first session, and this largely depends on their personal preference or theoretical orientation, which I understand, because some people might want to wait a session or two before getting to this deeply personal and potentially very sensitive and triggering information from a client. Is it okay for clients to cry in a therapy? So I was actually rather shocked that people didn't think it was okay to cry during therapy, because to me, therapy is a deeply emotional process that brings up a lot of emotions, traumatic experiences and more. And if I take my own experiences, then I think I've come close to crying about 2 or 3 times in my therapy sessions. It's a bit strange that people don't think crying is okay. Granted, I know at least in the UK there is a lot of societal and gender social norms at play here, like the absolutely rubbish idea that men shouldn't cry, amongst other myths. So it is just annoying that these rubbish ideas continue into the therapy room. somewhere that is meant to be a safe space. Overall, it's probably okay to cry in a therapy, but the therapist will respond in an empathetic and non-judgmental way. And if a client embarrasses your client, or a client wants to cry but they can't because of an emotional block, then this might be something to explore with them in therapy. Is it normal to be nervous starting therapy? Personally, I would find it really strange if someone wasn't nervous about starting therapy. Because I've studied psychology for almost half a decade now at university level. That is quite scary to think I've spent half a decade studying psychology. Plus, it's actually 7 years because I did it during a sixth form. So 7 years of studying psychology, and I'm not tired yet, I'm not bored, which I think is a really good sign. So anyway, yet I was still really nervous, because as I always say, when it comes to therapy, we are asking clients to reveal their deepest, perhaps darkest secrets, thoughts and behaviours, something that our clients might be ashamed of, and we are asking them to tell us, people who are effectively strangers. And this takes an immense amount of courage from our clients, but it's extremely scary too. Thankfully, we might want to tell our clients that as they get to know us, this nervousness starts to decrease. And if a client still feels anxious about therapy after a few sessions, then the client should probably talk to us about it, so we can talk about it and help them. And I remember from my first and second and lots of therapy, I was really nervous about my first lot because I'd never done it before. I didn't know what was going to happen and I wasn't sure if this was the right thing to do. Then I was a little nervous about my second lot of therapy with someone else at the university. But both went fine and I really liked both of them. Should a client prepare for the first therapy session? In my experience, this really does depend on the individual client. But some people are happy just to go into therapy without a plan or without doing any sort of prep work at all. Whereas I know other clients like to think about topics that they want to discuss and more. As well as clients like to think about the information they really, really want the therapist to know in the first session. Equally, therapists generally don't care if a client does any prep work beforehand or not. So it might be an idea to tell a client that prep work isn't needed, unless the client finds it really helpful. So I thought I would add a rather large personal dimension to this podcast episode. So I actually went through some of my old notebooks and some of my old pads, and I actually found what I wrote down just before my therapy sessions on both times. So this is what I wrote about my first one. So open quote basically. Tell her about general family structure, my self-harm and suicide stuff, beating threats, invalidation, coming out, X for 2 weeks, and invalidation and the conditions I had to live under, last week, the guilt I feel now. What do I want out of this? Healthier, more adaptive coping mechanisms for dealing with negative emotions, self-acceptance, less guilt, dealing with the lies. And then also, because I'm a massive fan of CBT, I also wrote down some protective factors. So, podcast audience and readers, yes, I do class you all as protective factors. My closer friends, wanting to come to therapy, me wanting an autism diagnosis, and going to continued support at university. Now, I do want to make a comment on all of this in a minute, but I want to make another comment first. Therefore, as you can see, to help me feel prepared and ready for my first therapy session, I did a little bit of prep work, and I thought about what I wanted to tell her. I also did a similar thing for my bunch of therapy at the university. So I wrote down the following, and this is a lot shorter. Areas of concern. Who am I? Feel lost now. Don't care about degree, just doing it and unsure about future now that I live. Fragility and lack of resilience these days. Also, I want to do some work on friendships and perceptions. Am I expecting too much from friendships? Close quote. And I think going through these old notes was actually quite fascinating because there are real snapshots about what I thought and how I felt in different stages in my life. To be honest, like the second therapy session, they only started in October. And they ran out in December. And then my first lot of like therapy, that was August. So it's not that long ago, but they're really clear snapshots in my life and what I felt and how I felt about at the time. So it's fascinating. Because I don't agree with any of that now, or I don't feel like any of that anymore. Overall, I hope these short little egg examples have shown you and help you to understand how some clients might want to prepare for the first therapy session, even though I never actually used these notes in my first sessions, but I still found them useful to do at the time. What does the therapist ask in a first session? So I was nowhere different from any other client when I went for my first session, because I had no idea what to expect, no idea what was going to be asked, and it was difficult. So this is why this podcast episode is also rather useful for psychology students, because this helps us to understand what actually happens in a first therapy session as well. Therefore, it might be useful for clients to know that the first therapy sessions are typically broad brushstrokes about what brought them to a therapy, their general autobiography, and then towards the end of the session, the therapist and a client talk about what the rest of the session should cover. In addition, therapists should tell clients that they will probably ask about the specific mental health difficulty that has made them want to come to therapy, what the client wants to achieve from the therapy, any therapeutic experiences the client has had in the past, and a brief life story. Also, in the first session at the beginning, you'll do some basic paperwork with the client for obvious reasons. For instance, my therapist got me to complete and sign a counselling contract, some medical information, and she explained to me her therapeutic orientation, which I learned a lot from, and I've spoken about them before in previous podcast episodes. Conclusion. When it comes to psychotherapy, I will always advocate for empirically supported therapies, whilst they can be brilliant, useful, and they can change someone's life for the better. I am proof of that, and my life is a million times better than it was before therapy. However, this improvement doesn't mean my first therapy session was easy. I was still nervous, concerned, and I had no idea what to expect. So, with this podcast focusing on psychology students and psychology professionals, I hope you now have a better understanding of how our clients might feel before they start therapy. You might want to use this information to help reassure them before their first session or not. That's okay. But you now have the understanding and the knowledge, and that can be a powerful thing. Especially when it comes to improving someone's life by decreasing their psychological distress, giving them hope, and helping them change their life for the better. So I really hope that you enjoyed today's episode and you got something out of it. I know that I did, because this was just a nice change of tack, and it was just like a nice fun podcast episode that wasn't too intense, and this stuff is just interesting to me. And if you know anyone who would enjoy today's episode, then please share it with them. I'm always really grateful when you wonderful people help us spread the word about the podcast. And if you want to learn more, definitely check out Social Media Psychology, available in all the usual places. And if you want to become a patron of the show, now you can at patreon.com/thepsychologyworldpodcast. So have a great day, everyone, and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. Please remember to like the video and subscribe to the YouTube channel and follow the podcast on your favourite podcast app. And if you wanted to learn more, then please check out the backlist of the podcast episodes or my books at conwhiteley.net. So have a great day and I'll see you next time.